Strap on your parachute. It's time for What Goes Up.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly Bloomberg Markets podcast. I'm Mike Breegan, a senior editor at Bloomberg. And this week on the show, the armies of gung-ho retail traders who were so influential on the stock market in the past year, well, they seem to have sobered up a bit, and the market has stopped going straight up. Are these two topics related? And do sky-high valuations mean a bigger correction is inevitable? We'll get into it with a veteran Wall Street strategist. But first, Charlie Pellett, tell us who is this week's mystery co-host.
This week's mystery co-host is Sid Verma. Sid is a senior editor with Bloomberg's cross-asset team in London. His hobbies include trolling Joe Weisenthal on Twitter. And while he and Mike Regan share the title of senior editor, Sid is much younger and nowhere near as washed up as Regan. Sid claims his parents are proud of him, even though he never did become a doctor.
Sid, I'm going to need to talk to Charlie about these intros. I'm not sure what I did to get on his bad side. Maybe I didn't stand clear of the closing doors the right way or something. But anyway, Dr. Sid Verma, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I mean, if Charlie says it, it's true. I feel like this is a Bloomberg rite of passage.
Sid, before we get into the markets, I wanted to get a sense from you of what it's like in London these days, especially now that the pubs are back open. I can't really picture London with closed pubs. I mean, is it really London if the pubs aren't open?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of pernicious effects. A lot of people were forced to talk to their family, express their emotions in a civilized way, and basically fraternize with their neighbors and do very American style subversive things like go do fitness and go enter the positivity industrial complex that is Instagram and exercise routines. Now things are opening up, so hopefully we can get to the London of old. And yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I don't know how much you guys have been going out, but I went out and it's kind of, you're relearning social norms when you go to the pub, when you're queuing to actually get a round in. And it's kind of, we're entering new territory.
Anyway, let's get to that markets chat with our guest. Our guest this week has a list of awards and accomplishments that's a mile long. But in my opinion, her biggest claim to fame is that, like me, she's a graduate of the number one university in the state of Delaware. She is the chief investment strategist at Charles Schwab, and her name is Lizanne Saunders. Lizanne, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Mike. Thanks for having me. And hi, Sid. How are you?
Very well. Thank you very much.
And Lizanne, it's very nice of you to not point out that I've made that same joke about the best school in the state of Delaware probably every time we've been in the same room together. So I appreciate that.
That's okay. Hey, we have the President of the United States is also a Blue Hen. So, the alumni is moving up in the world.
Listen, let's start with that idea of the individual retail investors. There's this sense, at least in the media, that the Reddit type of traders have sort of sobered up a bit and at least aren't chasing meme stocks the way they used to. From your perspective, I'm curious if you think that's true. And I wonder if in the past year or so, when you're trying to analyze the market, if you've been sort of looking in the mirror a little bit more than normal. In other words, looking at what the retail investors at Schwab and elsewhere have been doing, if they're moving as a flock, and what sort of the sentiment is there among that cohort right now?
Yeah, so there are some indications that the robust volume driven by that crowd, the newly minted day traders, the Reddit crowd, whatever you want to call it, and it's broader than just the Reddit flash mobs that became so in the news in the January-February timeframe. But if you look more broadly, there's some indication that there's a little bit of a waning in terms of that participation. But it also sometimes gets masked because the outset of interest by that fairly new cohort dates back to the June-July period of last year. And it didn't, that cohort didn't get as much attention, even though the likes of Citadel came out last summer and said that retail traders represented 20 to 25% of daily volume. But where their interest was most dominant within the market, at least outside of the options market, were in the FANG type stocks in the big five names that were otherwise the leadership names. So their activity blended into what was otherwise working in the market. It really wasn't until the beginning of this year that that cohort got more interested in the meme stocks, heavily shorted stocks, weak balance sheet companies, penny sheet stocks, some of the SPACs, obviously cryptos. So it was just more noticeable when it was in those lower quality, not sort of typical leadership areas of the market. What we don't know is whether that money is sort of morphed back into where leadership has been more recently. Really, since mid-February, we've seen a shift, believe it or not, back toward some semblance of fundamentals driving stocks, a bit more of a quality bias, profitability bias, a little bit of a valuation bias. Notice I say valuation, not value, because I think those sometimes are separate. So it's going to be interesting to see when we really open back up and assuming people or some percentage of people go back to work and we've got sports betting again, whether some of the forces that drove that cohort to a level of interest that we'd not seen before, whether that fades a bit or whether we truly have brought them into the world of investing for a more extended period of time.
We've seen this whole euphoria in markets. As you've explained, a lot of it has been retail driven. One thing that is incredibly different from this business cycle compared to other crisis eras has been the fact that savings rates amongst the middle class has stood out very respectfully. And, you know, this is down to fiscal policy redress and other such factors. What could challenge this business cycle? I guess it's just like a business cycle like no other. You know, if we forget about exogenous shocks, which no one can predict, and just think of broader forces. I mean, I'm used to thinking of business cycles as young, you know, middle-aged and old. That kind of framework seems kind of out of place because we seem to be going back to the pre-COVID business cycle. It seems that people are talking about wage inflation and that could reduce corporate margins and lead to a bit of overheating. I find that's a really interesting question. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that this cycle, you're right, is more unique than any we have seen in the past. And I'm not even sure there's a consensus assumption of what the path of recovery looks like from here. It's sort of all over the map from the more bearish end of the spectrum that believes this is just a fiscal stimulus sugar high. We'll get the inevitable pop in the data by virtue of base effects. But that after that, we're going to quickly move back down to a pretty subdued pace of growth, much like we had pre-pandemic. So we have to remember, for all the cheering about the cycle that preceded this, and it's factual that it was the longest economic expansion in history and had lovely stats associated with it, like a 3.5% unemployment rate. But the reality is that the strength of the expansion was the weakest in history by far. So long, yes, weak, yes. And so I'd say the negative case is that we're going to revert back down to that muddle through kind of pace. And then, of course, at the other end of the spectrum is the roaring 20s kind of scenario. I think the honest answer that I can provide is I have no idea. I think you mentioned at the outset of the question the savings rate, and certainly embedded in the more optimistic case for the economy is that if that savings rate goes from the current 20% down to this, say, 5-7% that's been typical in the last cycle or two, do the math of how many trillions of dollars that means in the consumption pipeline and even going ahead forward where we're not going to have the benefit of fiscal stimulus, that's enough to power the economy for years to come. I don't know that that's a safe assumption. What we don't know is whether, like the Great Depression, whether this also ushered out a paradox of thrift, an era where there's a mindset toward lower debt levels, a higher cushion. We already knew that household deleveraging came out of the financial crisis, and we never levered up the consumer side of the economy in the last expansion like we had in the prior expansion. Debt pay down was paramount in thinking. We still had strong consumption data, but it wasn't on the back of debt. And what we don't know is whether that savings cushion is going to stay higher. The other potential faulty assumption, I think, in the really robust case is that pent-up demand is both really robust on the good side and the services side of the economy, and that it's likely to be persistent. And I just question that piece of the really optimistic story, because the good side of the economy, we are well above pre-pandemic levels. So arguably, the demand has been extraordinarily strong consistently for the past year, and that demand has been met. So if anything, I think the pent-up demand will be much more on the services side. And just the nature of pent-up demand on services is a bit different. It's a little more one-time in nature. So I do worry that as we start to get these really strong numbers, that there might be too much extrapolating too far into the future. I think there are still a lot of questions to which we don't have answers.
As a journalist, I've never extrapolated from one-time data.
Well, one thing I find fascinating about the savings rate is it's such a simplistic calculation. You know, it's basically income minus consumption. And I don't think we get a lot of sort of granularity about where that savings is. You know, I wonder how much of that savings is actually housed in brokerage accounts. And if we do start talking about a drawdown in savings, does that mean, you know, emptying out your Schwab account? God forbid, Liz, you know, God forbid. But
well, it depends on, honestly, what's going to be the interesting test is at whatever point we get something more than the 6-8% pullback, which is what we've been limited to in the past year. You had one in June, you had a period in September, October, where you got a couple. We didn't really have it for the S&P. You did get a 10% correction in the NASDAQ earlier this year. But at the inevitable point, something is a bit more severe than that, an actual correction, a 15% severe correction, even, you know, God forbid, a bear market. Sort of what we saw last year was it almost stimulated that cohort a bit more. It didn't scare them off. And they looked at it the way we all know we're supposed to, which is, boy, now we can buy cheaper. But what we don't know is whether the inevitable something more severe, and I don't have any crystal ball on the timing of that, what we see with that cohort.
You know, are bonds too boring for retail investors these days? Looking at rates of returns, and do you think treasuries and bond products need to be marketed to be fun to get the online meme crowd interested in the asset class?
Well, I would argue that a lot of the online meme crowd, and I don't want to generalize here, are largely pure momentum players. I don't think they're doing a tremendous amount of kind of deep fundamental analysis like many of us do that have been long in the business. And I think on the fixed income side, I think that that's the same thing. I don't think there's a lot of understanding on how the bond market works, the nature of truly what is a bond bear market relative to an equity bear market. What the correlations are depending on what is maybe causing the rise in yields, the growth component, the inflation component, when it starts to hit the equity market, the impact it has on valuations, but how it still can serve as a diversifier, what you do when rates are rising in terms of how to position your fixed income portfolio, whether it's barbells or ladders or longer duration or short duration. I've had conversations like this with some younger, newer investors, and their eyes sort of glaze over. Maybe it does mean you need more confetti and excitement, but if the bond market becomes an area where there's momentum in one direction or another, could that crowd follow it and try to play that trend? Sure.
You know, Lizanne, you had an interesting note recently. The title is "The Stock Market Disconnected from the Economy." And what struck me in that is a really cool graphic you had, where you go through, I don't know, it's about 10 or a dozen of some of the most commonly looked at valuation metrics. A few obscure ones, you know, like the Buffett indicator, the ratio of market cap to GDP, Tobin's Q, the ratio of market cap to replacement value of assets. And to describe the graphic, on the left side, it was green, meaning sort of valuations were attractive. The right side was red, meaning unattractive valuations. pretty much everything was pinned to the right, to the red, except for the metrics that are influenced by the interest rates, like the Fed model and that sort of thing, which kind of explains why the market tends to have a freak out when rates suddenly have lurched higher a few times over this year. And as you point out, though, the stock market is forward looking. So, you know, there is a case to be made to maybe not take all these metrics as seriously as perhaps you would have in a more normal environment when the base effects weren't so ridiculous compared to last year. And we actually did a story not too long ago about people more or less trying to shoot down each and every one of these type of metrics. And I get it in one way. I totally get it. And as you point out in your note, valuations are lousy market timing tools. I mean, really, probably everything is a lousy market timing tool when you get to it. But still, I can't help but wonder, you know, whenever you hear the paradigm has shifted and this time is different, it just makes me nervous. It makes me think of to some of the turn of the century zeitgeist of looking at new metrics and not worrying about the traditional metrics. How are you thinking about all that? I mean, is it more of a expect weaker returns over, say, the not so distant future than it is trying to worry about an imminent correction? You know, how do you sort of incorporate these valuation extremes into what you're thinking about the future?
Sure. So when I wrote that report recently, and in conjunction with that heat map, I highlighted as one example what you mentioned, which is valuation, at least in the shortish term, is a terrible timing indicator. And I agree with you. If there's no such thing as a perfect timing tool, if there were, boy, this would be easy, and it's not. But it looked at the forward PE historically and then subsequent one-year performance. And in this case, it was for the S&P 500. And yes, there is a negative correlation, meaning higher PE ratios have been followed by lower one-year performance and vice versa. But it was a very small negative correlation, only 0.18. And if you look at a scattergram, which I put in the report, the observations, the individual observations are far and wide. They're literally all over the map. There's plenty of instances, and you can certainly go back to the late 1990s to see some of them where you were in stratospheric valuation territory, but you still had a pretty robust runway before ultimately the market peaked out. I think the key difference in the current environment versus, say, the rise into 2000, and this doesn't suggests that I think it's all clear ahead and that there's no valid comps to the excess of the late 90s. And there are a lot of valid comps, but the one potential offset to some of those concerns is that into the peak in 2000, when the S&P's PE for a couple of years had been hovering around the 27 level, underlying that, the earnings, the denominator on a forward basis was also rising. It's just prices were rising more robustly than earnings. What we now know with the benefit of hindsight is that earnings were rising at the time, but they were rising into a peak. What caused the parabolic spike in the PE in the current environment was, of course, last year's epic plunge in earnings. And needless to say, the plunge in earnings last year was not your typical dip in earnings. It was an epic depression era reaction to what was going on in the economy. And unlike circa 2000, we're now on the upswing in earnings, which had the effect of quickly seeing once we rolled into an improving forward four quarters, most of which was now in 2021, you saw the forward PE drop quickly from 27 down to 22. It's popped up a little bit since then. And I'm certainly not suggesting that a 22 or 23 PE is cheap, but there is the potential that if, like last year, this year's earnings bar is still set on the low side, that ultimately where earnings move to could continue to bring down valuation levels. Now, it's in conjunction with still really frothy sentiment, which has been positively offset by strong breadth. But breadth is starting to look a little shakier and is quite weak for NASDAQ and Russell 2000. It's been kind of hanging in there for the S&P. So I think that's really key to watch, because when you have, like in 2000, wildly optimistic sentiment, but deteriorating breadth and an earnings trajectory that is peaking, that's sort of a triple whammy on the negative side. And we only have sort of formally the sentiment concern, but the other two are absolutely worth watching because the market is by no means cheap.
I mean, implicit in that scenario is the idea that perhaps value and cyclical stocks might not be able to pick up the slack if some of the big mega caps disappoint. And, you know, we saw some of the story take a shine with Netflix earnings and so forth. And breadth has already improved as well. We've seen a large number of members actually trade above their 200-day or 50-day moving average recently. And so it's a huge conundrum when it comes to just how much good prices or good news is already priced into value and cyclical stocks. What's your view on that part of the market?
So I think what's been going on from a value perspective has more to do with the sectors that were doing well for that span of time, in particular from late October until about mid-February of this year. And there were fundamental drivers to that. In the case of financials, it was rates going up, a steepening of the yield curve. In the case of energy, obviously, it was an improvement in global economic growth, sort of China coming back in from a demand perspective. And then industrials was also driven by China sort of coming out of the COVID environment and seeing a ramp in economic activity. Well, those sectors happen to be dominant in the value indexes. So I think it was more of a sector driver than it was a shift into value. Now I think we're in an environment where valuation, where a focus on the factor of value is essential, I think, for particularly for individual stock pickers that want to try to be in the types of stocks and parts of the market that will do well. It's almost a hybrid or GARPy kind of approach, which has really started to work in the last month. And it's part of the reason why active managers have been doing better relative to passive managers, why equal weighted has been performing better relative to cap weighted. So I think there is a shift towards sort of a value mindset, which can be very distinct from value indexes doing well. One of the reasons why we don't put tactical recommendations on growth versus value, even though we will on large versus small, is I think there are times where there can be a huge difference between growth and value in terms of the types of stocks housed in the indexes versus the fundamentals of, say, value. You know, in October of 2002, after the tech bust, NASDAQ 100 down 83% peak to trough, overall NASDAQ down 78%, S&P down 57%. If you wanted to buy deep value, and you did well in doing so, a lot of that deep value was found in the tech stocks that were still housed in the Russell Growth Indexes. More recently, utilities became really expensive. That doesn't mean Russell moves them into the growth indexes. They're not growth stocks. They're just really expensive stocks that are housed in the value indexes, sometimes called the value trap. So when I say that I think investors should have a value mindset, that shouldn't be seen as the same comment as just take a passive approach and just blindly buy, you know, the value indexes, either Russell or S&P or other symmetric. I think now we need to be factor oriented. I think cyclical leverage to an upturn in the economy, but that doesn't mean just think of what typical cyclicals are. Hey, listen to what, you know, the first 6 months of this bull market last year, it was the defensive names that did well. But this era's defensive names were the big five. They were Apple, Microsoft, Google, Netflix, Amazon. Typical defensive areas are staples and utilities, but this cycle just had a different definition of what was defensive. And I think this cycle is probably going to have a different definition of what is cyclical, where the cyclical leverage is. It's probably going to be in segments of the market that might have a lot of the stocks housed in the growth indexes, but that's where the damage was most significant in terms of the economy and the stocks. So yes, value factor that I think will still work. Cyclical, yes, but don't think of that just in terms of the traditional definitions and the traditional labeling and housing in terms of standard indexes.
Yeah, I think one of the craziest things I saw of the year was looking at the growth estimates for the value indexes and the growth indexes and the the earnings growth estimates were higher for the value index than for the growth index.
Just right, because that's where, I mean, look at what's going to happen in the second quarter. I think the Refinitiv consensus for earnings growth in the second quarter for energy is four digits. I think it's over 1,000%. So the areas of the economy that got most severely hit are going to be where you see the greatest growth characteristics. So its characteristics are very different than index constituents.
I will say, Lizanne, Refinitiv, we've never heard of it. Never heard of that particular company. But just to shift gears a little bit, you had a good note talking about the federal debt. Obviously, it's exploded. Fiscal stimulus has been such a huge driver for once of both, you know, the economic recovery and the market. I think if for a lot of people getting a $1,400 check, it's kind of like house money that you can go then, sure, you know, bet on meme stocks or whatnot.
But I think what also drove that cohort, of course, also may have had something to do with zero commissions,
right,
which we at right. Schwab may have right. had something right. to do with. And then things like stock slices, as we call them, fractional shares. So I think it was a confluence of events, but certainly the stimulus checks as a feeder into accounts that now allow you to trade free and more easily. Yes, it was all part of the recipe.
You know, if we all put our politics for aside and just look at the debt analytically about, you know, what it could or could not be a headwind or a tailwind to growth. Obviously, I think, you know, the glory days of fiscal stimulus are probably behind us. I mean, maybe, you know, if we're lucky, we'll get some sort of infrastructure bill. But I mean, the big work is already done there. Walk us through sort of that work you did on the debt and what it means as it relates to the economy.
Sure. So first, let's talk about the deficit, which, of course, is the annual mismatch of what's coming in and going out. And then debt is a cumulative effect of running deficits. And debt, of course, can be categorized in a number of different ways. Typically, these days, when we talk about debt, most people are talking about federal government debt. But, you know, add to that state and local debt, non-financial sector debt, corporate debt, and every variety of household debt. And whereas government debt is gone above 100% of GDP this year, and that's just federal government debt, total credit market debt is closer to about 400% of GDP, which, by the way, doesn't include any of the future debt associated with unfunded entitlements. That's when you get up into the, you know, 900, 1,000% of GDP. But what's amazing to me, and again, not to get political, but here I'm gonna be a bipartisan critic. It's amazing to me how many people I hear in Washington, senators, congresspeople, who when talking about either the deficit or the debt, will conflate the two. And as they're talking about the deficit, I think they're actually talking about debt. And I don't know whether many of these people, and I've heard both sides of the aisle do it, I don't know whether they don't know the difference or they do and they're trying to confuse people. Sadly, it's probably the former. You know, in terms of the stock market, what's interesting, and this is just simple fact, this is not an assessment on my part that deficits don't matter, but there's been a positive correlation with the deficit in the stock market. Higher levels of a deficit as a share of GDP have typically been accompanied by better stock market performance. Moving on to the debt, though, clearly the environment we're in, you talk about headwinds associated with debt. And typically I get the question in terms of at what point do we hit a wall? At what point looking forward does it start to become a problem, however one defines a problem? And my argument, it has been a problem for quite some time. Now, it's a bit of a chicken and an egg argument. Nonetheless, going back, the long history of data that we have on economic activity across the spectrum of GDP, productivity, inflation, capital spending, housing, and total credit market debt. So not just government debt, but total credit market debt. Lower zones of debt have been accompanied by much higher economic growth. Higher zones of debt, much lower economic growth. You know, I talked earlier about, yes, the last expansion was the longest in history, but it was also the weakest. I think the high and rising burden of debt was a contributing factor to that. Now, the chicken and the egg piece of it comes with, well, because growth has been subdued for whatever reasons, maybe demographics or lack of productivity, that has in turn stimulated more fiscal stimulus, which is added to the deficit, which is added to the debt. So that's the chicken and egg argument. Nonetheless, we can go outside the United States, look at Japan, which has much higher debt levels, certainly government debt levels than we do, and they've had unbelievably weak growth. But interestingly, accompanying that has been low levels of inflation. So where I disagree with some of what the consensus is, that this high and rising burden of debt is an inflation accident waiting to happen. For decades and decades and decades, there's been a complete mirror image relationship than what the consensus believes. Higher zones of debt have historically been accompanied by lower inflation rates, largely because it tends to be accompanied by lower economic growth. So I don't worry about the inflation piece as it relates to debt. But I worry, especially as interest rates go up further than they already have, that it's the crowding out effect and a much greater share of revenues coming in have to be devoted simply to paying interest on that debt.
But what evidence do we have that public sector spending has had a crowding effect already? What evidence do we have if it's the classic crowding out effect? I don't see much evidence of crowding out yet.
I agree with you. I agree with you. What we can look at prospectively is all the big areas that government spends money on, whether it's education, health, defense, and look at the growth rate expected based on, you know, CBO assumptions, and then look at some sort of standard assumption of the change in interest rates over the next 10 years and what the growth rate in servicing that debt will be, the growth rate and the interest on debt. The growth rate is going through the roof. But if we are truly all MMTers now and we're in a different paradigm where we're just not going to worry about it and we're going to spend at a level akin to what we've seen this year and disregard any concern about deficits in the near to medium term, then I agree with you. It isn't automatically the case that a high and rising burden of debt crowds out spending or investments elsewhere. I think we're at the beginning of an experiment to see whether we are in a different MMT-like paradigm, of which there is implicit supporters on both sides of the aisle. If there's one area of somewhat bipartisan support or a game that both sides are playing pretty effectively right now, it's kicking the can down the road. So I agree with you. We may not have to sort of face the implications of that crowding out effect because it's not something that's a worry right now.
I wonder if, you know, MMT works if you are guaranteed that you're the global reserve currency and that oil continues to be traded in dollars. You know, if the Saudis decide that they want to sell their oil in euros or renminbi or Dogecoin or whatever and start keeping reserves in other currencies, if that sort of upturns the case for MMT a little bit.
Well, that's certainly a big part of the case, that we sit in this extraordinary, you know, privileged chair of having being the global monetary standard and having the world's reserve currency. And I do think, possibly even in my lifetime, we live in a world where there are multiple reserve currencies. But in terms of the dominance of the dollar and it representing the monetary standard, when you look at what percent the dollar represents in global reserves, the percent represented in global trade, and how the doomsayers have been suggesting a plunge in that for decades, that I don't buy. I see the idea as we have more sort of siloed segments of the global economy that there will be the emergence of more regional transaction with local currencies. I think that's the nature of technology and the speed with which that can be done and translations can be done. But I don't worry about the dollar losing its reserve status. There's really not many countries, if any, you can think of that, certainly not China. I get the question all the time, well, what would stop them from just dumping their treasury securities? Well, if that would be aiming the gun squarely at their own economic foot. So I'm not sure they want to do that to make some point. And there just is nothing out there, including the Chinese yuan or the euro, that has anywhere near the weight in those metrics on percent of reserves, foreign trade, that I think dethrones the dollar anytime soon. So that as an underlying sort of basis for MMT, which I don't fully agree that it's a theory that can persist ad infinitum without negative consequences. But I don't worry about the dollar losing its reserve status. But I think you can have that view, but still take issue with MMT.
Sid, I brought up that was no accident, me bringing up Dogecoin. That is meant to be the segue to the part of the show that I think a lot of listeners tune in. Charlie Pellett, once again, will tell us what that is.
Tighten up your straitjackets. It's time for the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
So, Sid, I have a lot of faith in you to deliver us with the craziest thing you ever saw this week. A lot of faith that'll be a good one. What do you have for us?
There are lots of crazy things that have been happening in recent weeks, but I think one crazy thing that I don't think has got any attention whatsoever is the fact that Ghana came out, the country of Ghana came out with a zero coupon bond. And this is after they tried to go for a century bond. And the zero coupon bonds are just weird instruments, and they found ample demand, and they found a way to issue whilst trying to pacify credit rating agencies. And to me, that was an interesting deal about how credit markets just all the firepower and all the leverage is with borrowers. And this week, for example, I was on a call with some of my colleagues, and we find that European distress funds are buying high quality, effectively buying much higher quality credits than you could ever imagine, because there's just a shortage of investable assets. So when you see Ghana and emerging market issuers able to do funky stuff like that, that always gets me interested.
That is, I assume that's a local currency bond, not a dollar bond.
That is actually a euro bond.
Euro bond. Wow,
it's a zero coupon bond, but it's usually more volatile than bonds that pay regular interest. So it's definitely one of the weirder things out there.
Lizette, are you going to put any clients into a zero coupon Ghana bond?
I don't personally put any clients' money anywhere, and they should all be very thankful for that. But I would say as a company, no, I don't think you're going to see it on any Schwab recommended list anytime soon. Just a guess.
What, Lizanne, anything crazy from you this week?
Yeah, you already used it to tease this segment, Dogecoin. I have trouble sort of getting a lot about the valid cryptocurrencies, if you want to call it that, let alone something that was started as a joke. So I've been shaking my head at that one, I have to admit.
Okay, well, you're going to shake it even harder when you hear my craziest thing, because this is a little self-indulgent, but I actually tweeted out a chart of the S&P 500 priced in Dogecoin. Denominated in Dogecoin. Simple ratio of the S&P level to Dogecoin. Possibly the stupidest thing on Twitter this week, as well as the craziest thing. And I'm proud of that, because that's not an easy accomplishment, given Twitter what it is. But here's where we're going to have some fun. Is I like to turn this segment into kind of a quiz show, like The Price is Right. The S&P 500's done pretty well since the presidential election, at least since the day after I looked. It's up more than 20%. Since November 4th. Lizanne, what do you think the performance of the S&P 500 priced in Dogecoin has been since the U.S. election?
No idea, honestly. I haven't even done the calculation on what the performances of Dogecoin from whatever recent trough to whatever recent high. So I'm not even going to venture a guess.
I imagine your bosses and the Schwab clients are probably happy to hear that.
That I'm not spending my time looking. Yes. I hope they're happy to hear that.
My bosses maybe not as happy to hear me doing ratios. Sid, what's your guess at the Dogecoin denominated performance of the S&P 500 since Election Day?
I'm going to say it's Good? I seriously don't know.
Down 99%. But it, you know, it, I do think there's a serious point to be made, Lizanne, is that people are throwing money at things that are literally jokes. You know, maybe GameStop had some, you know, fundamental turnaround story. I don't know. But, you know, a lot of people are just trading on the memes. I just can't wrap my head around it.
Neither can I. It's not even, you know, what they say often, or what many often say about just the other cryptocurrencies, is that at this stage, it's less a currency. Let's use Bitcoin as an example, less a currency, less an investment, more a religion. You know, it's very faith-based. I don't even know how to categorize something like Dogecoin. It's just, it's, we're at some point, we're going to look back, whether that's going to be the poster child, but there will be some poster children associated with us looking back at some point and thinking, how did people not see this?
Yeah. I think it was created with the intention to be the poster child of excess.
I mean, that's quite a puritanical way of looking at it. I mean, no one who's buying Dogecoin thinks it's going to be changing the world, like the Bitcoin believers argue. No one believes that it's going to be a medium of exchange or store of value. You have market participants who fully aware that it's ridiculous, but find it fun. Isn't it, you know, similar just to buying expensive shoes, you know, having a night out on the town? It's an experience that everyone's enjoying.
It's the greater fool theory. It's, you know, if somebody else is willing to pay an even more ridiculous sum, then I'm a winner.
It's only that greatest fool who gets stuck holding the bag, I guess. But with that, I think we have run out of time. Lizanne, always such a pleasure to catch up with you. Appreciate your time. And I know you're in Florida now, so wear that sunscreen. Be sure to wear the sunscreen.
I always do. I'm inside working. I'm in front of this camera all the time. And it's not a fake backdrop. I'm actually inside, not outside. But it's a lovely place to live.
All right. And my old co-host, Sarah Ponczak, moved to Florida, too. So if you see her, say hello. And Sid, Dr. Sid Verma, very happy to have you on the show. I hope we can get you back, too.
Thank you very much for having me.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Sid Verma is at _SidVerma. This week's guest, Lizanne Saunders, is at Lizanne Saunders. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcast. And thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Laura Carlson. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.